All right, welcome back, everybody. We're here now for the second case today, and this is called Joe Anthony Martinez versus the people of the state of Colorado. Could I have the attorney for Mr. Martinez introduce herself, please? All right, thank you. And for the state of Colorado, please.
I'm Elizabeth Warbaugh, representing the state of Colorado.
Thank you. This case is set for 1 hour, that means each of you have half an hour. You'll have to keep track of your own time, please. Please, whenever you're ready, Ms. Burke.
May it please the court, I'm Shannon Duffy here on behalf of petitioner Joe Martinez. First, I will discuss why the prosecution failed to prove that Mr. Martinez was complicit in first-degree murder. Then I hope it will be obvious why the government's time interval instruction is not harmless beyond reasonable doubt. In 1970, the United States Supreme Court addressed the proof beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof and its vital role in our criminal procedure. In In Re Winship, the court explained that, quote, it is critical that the moral force of the criminal law not be diluted by a standard proof that leaves people in doubt whether innocent men are being condemned. It is also important in our free society that every individual going about his ordinary affairs have confidence that his government cannot have judged him guilty of a criminal offense without convincing a proper fact finder of his guilt with utmost certainty. That's the court's language, utmost certainty. The requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt by the prosecution in a criminal case is, quote, bottomed on a fundamental value determination of our society, that it is far worse to convict an innocent man than to let a guilty man go free. In this case, the prosecution sought to hold Mr. Martinez accountable for the actions of Radio Tequila, the man who shot a victim. Because our criminal procedure does not allow the prosecution to prove guilt by association, the prosecution here sought to prove Martinez's guilt based on a theory of complicity. To hold Martinez accountable for Tequila's act of fatally shooting the victim, the prosecutor was required to prove as follows. One, that at the moment Tequila shot the victim, Tequila intended to kill, and that intent was formed after deliberation. Two, that Martinez had knowledge that Tequila intended to kill the victim and shared his intent to kill the victim. And three, that Martinez, with the knowledge of Tequila's intent to kill the victim and sharing that intent, Martinez must have aided, abetted, or encouraged Tequila in either the planning or commission of the shot to the head. And Martinez must have intended for his own conduct to promote or facilitate the shot to the head. That's from Martinez. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is lacking at every step of this analysis. First, I want to talk about the insufficient proof that Tequila's intent was formed after deliberation. While it appears clear that Tequila intended to kill the victim by shooting him in the head, we cannot say with utmost certainty that he formed that intent after deliberation. Deliberation requires the exercise of reflection and judgment, a cold-blooded act, so to speak, an act born out of the functioning of the frontal lobe of the brain which controls rational thought. That is what separates it from crimes committed in heat of passion. Heat of passion crimes are hasty and impulsive, born from the amygdala, the hindbrain, the part of the brain that triggers an aggressive response before the frontal lobe can rein it in. Crimes committed after deliberation are never hasty or impulsive. In this case, Tequila shot the victim in the head after his passions were aroused by the confrontation in the yard. He was no doubt overwhelmed. We know that it takes the brain 15 to 20 minutes to purge itself of the adrenal surge of fight or flight response and return to its normal chemical balance. It did not take 15 to 20 minutes for the victim to be dragged from the yard to the street. There is nowhere close to the utmost certainty that when Tiffany shot the victim in the head, that act was a product of reflection and judgment, as opposed to an impulsive act that was a product of a brain so flooded with hormones activated by a fight or flight response. Next, I want to talk about the insufficient proof that Martinez had knowledge that Tiffany had intended to kill the victim and shared his intent to kill the victim. The prosecution originally charged Martinez with conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. The trial court dismissed that charge at the preliminary hearing, finding that there was no proof that Martinez and Tiffany had formed a preconceived plan to kill the victim, and the prosecution did not appeal that ruling. We do know that the exact nature of the confrontation, we do not know the exact nature of the confrontation itself, including who was the initial aggressor, because there were no eyewitnesses to that particular confrontation. But the evidence suggests that the victim was shot in a zealous, perhaps overzealous attempt to protect the ex-wife and children that are inside the house. The gunshot wound to the victim in the yard fractured his right leg, rendered his right arm useless, and caused him to fall to the ground. There is no proof that Martinez intended for the victim to suffer death during this initial confrontation. Once the victim was dragged to the street, the nature of the confrontation evolved from an attempt at stopping the victim from making good on his death threats to the Tiffany's impulsive act of shooting the victim in the head. Even if we assume, for the sake of argument, that Tiffany's intent was formed after the exercise of reflection and judgment, the evidence does not prove with utmost certainty that Martinez ever knew of his intent to shoot the victim in the head until it actually happened. And Martinez did not know about Tiffany's intent to shoot the victim in the head. He could not have shared that intent, nor could he have intended any of his own actions to promote or facilitate the shot in the head. We don't even have to reach that view whether Martinez intentionally aided, abetted, or encouraged Tiffany in the shot in the head. Because there's insufficient evidence that Martinez knew of Tiffany's intent to shoot the victim in the head. But of course, that's step three. There's no proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Martinez aided or encouraged the shot to the head. The vast majority of witness testimony described Tiffany as yelling or cursing at the victim and then immediately shooting him in the head. In its statement of the facts, the Court of Appeals described the scene as follows on page 2 of the opinion. Quote, the neighbor testified that the shirtless man cursed at the victim and then shot him in the head. End quote. Another neighbor quote, heard one of the men swear at the victim and then fire a final shot, end quote. The court then described the 5 other witness testimonies as consistent with the first 2 accounts. Later in the opinion, on page 18, the court describes the scene as follows. Quote, the victim was then dragged from the yard into the street, where the defendant and Tapia stood over the victim and yelled obscenities at him. At that point, Tapia shot the victim in the head. There is no evidence that Martinez verbally or non-verbally encouraged the shot to the head. The complicity theory is based purely on circumstantial evidence, and even the Court of Appeals concluded that it was not the strongest circumstantial case. So where is the evidence proving with utmost certainty that Martinez was complicit in Tiffany's shot to the head? There is none. Next, I'm going to turn to the issue of instructional error. The trial court's language to the jury defined deliberation and premeditation, final language to the jury, read as follows in instruction number 12. The only time requirement for deliberation and premeditation is an interval sufficient for one thought to follow another. The length of time required for deliberation need not be long. We've argued in the briefs over the standard of review, and I'm not going to go over that point here unless you have questions for me about that. But this instruction constitutes reversible error in this case under any standard of review.
Ms. Jeffrey, yes. let me ask, do you think that the trial attorney properly preserved the objection?
I think she did her best, Your Honor. I think it was an artful. I'll concede that the language used was inappropriate to supplement the statutory instructional language. And she should have said erroneous instead of inappropriate. But she was trying, in a heated trial, to convey a point. And I think it was preserved at trial. If you really look at the dialogue between the court and the attorneys, as they got in the briefs, I think about she was trying to explain that while that language was in the Brennan and Hayden cases, that language was used to justify a finding of sufficiency in retrospect by appellate courts, that particular language was not appropriate as a jury instruction. Well, I think that's what she was trying to convey. And in that sense, I think she did preserve it.
Well, part of my sympathy goes to the trial judge in trying to identify that's what the objection was to direct, because the purpose of an objection is to say, hey, judge, you need to look at this specific point. I mean, there may be language that you could pick out that says it's inappropriate, but she also clearly condones the use of that language by saying clearly the law is now and has been recently that deliberation requires enough for one thought to follow another. And so part of the reason I'm sympathetic to the trial judge is we would get objections when I was on the court that would say, Judge, I object under the 14th Amendment to the Colorado and the United States Constitution. Not helpful for me to identify what they're asking. So do you think that this is specific enough that it drew the judge's attention to what the actual issue was that we are now arguing?
I think the statement that you just pointed out was perhaps the most remarkable statement that the defense counsel made. I think what she was trying to say was that, of course, deliberation requires enough time for one thought to follow another, that is the law, but that's not the only thing that it requires. And that statement diminishes the reflection and judgment language of the statutory definition. I do sympathize with the trial court as well, but I think at that point, we have multiple objections over that language. It is incumbent upon the trial court to do a little bit of legal research to see if that language was still the law in the context of the jury instruction. And I also want to say that the prosecution had the language, and the prosecution was assuring the court that it was the law, so I think there's some responsibility in speaking of the prosecution as well. But in any case, once this was raised in the motion for new trial, the trial court acknowledged that it was preserved error when ruling on that issue and analyzed it under the constitutional harmless error standard. So according to the trial court, it was good enough to preserve the error, even though the court didn't catch it.
All right, thank you.
Do you think that instruction 11 was fine the way it is with that 12?
I'm sorry, popping off that part of that question. Was 11 the one?
Well, 11, 11 is the one that has after deliberation means not only intentionally, but also that the decision to commit this act has been made after the exercise of reflection and judgment concerning the act. An act committed after deliberation is never one which has been committed in a hasty or impulsive manner.
I think standing alone is the correct.
That was fine. So the problem is, and the council flagged this, giving instruction number 12 at all.
That's part of the problem, yes. Giving it at all is a problem. It's also a problem if it's given last. And I went into that in my reply brief, because in the Franklin case by the U.S. Supreme Court, they talk about how when there are contradictory definitions of a mental state instruction, many times the instruction given last is the one that sticks in the jury's mind. It's considered superseding or final authority.
And the problem with 12 is it could happen like this, one thought after another. No deliberation.
That's right. That's three thoughts in succession, right?
Right.
But that's not necessarily the reflection. That's not necessarily deliberating, because that could have been my hindbrain response, my fight-or-flight response. There's a lot more that goes into the analysis.
So the problem is that 12 overrides 11.
It does.
11 basically says, hey, you really have to have opportunity to think about this. 12 says, you really don't have to think about it.
That's correct. Rapid succession. 2009 succession.
Counselor, your
description of deliberative process here seems to presume that the only opportunity to deliberate was in that split second when Tapia raised the gun and then fired it at the victim's head. And I'm wondering, why are we limited to that narrow window of time? Could deliberation have formed earlier in that sequence on the porch in the process of dragging the victim out into the street? Why are we limited to that? And I'm curious, was that what was argued by the prosecution, that deliberation was formed in that split second? Or was deliberation, I mean, what was the argument presented, I guess, to the jury about deliberation?
I'll answer that last part first, and please remind me to answer that. I believe what was argued to the jury was that Martina and Tapia were acting in concert in time with Tom. But here's what's interesting. What's interesting is that in the closing arguments and the opening statements, there was a lot of passive voice use, just like in the opinion and in the briefs here, because we don't know who was acting on the front porch. We don't know who fired the shots. We don't know who grabbed who we were. And so really, the prosecutor was left just to argue that those things occurred and that there was a one general intent, because the prosecutor could not parse out what Martinez's intent was versus what Tapia's intent was. The prosecution and the appellate court treated them as an identical entity, but that's not what the complicity statute requires us to do. The complicity statute requires us to look at them as individuals, as principal and alleged complicitor, and to go through those steps and really analyze whether the evidence in the case proves up those problems of complicity.
So is it your position that the only evidence presented to the jury that presented a clear opportunity for deliberation was in that final moment? There's no other evidence to an utmost certainty or the standard that you articulated that precedes that final act?
I think that because the initial confrontation we learned was reactionary, it was reactionary to the phone calls that were made and then the victim coming over armed, still armed, even though it was a bit of a reactionary confrontation, and evidence points to the five shots in the yard reacting to some perceived threat. Now, that's a different confrontation than what happened in the street. And that's why I do think we have to narrow our focus to what happened in the street. Because, well, it might be more persuasive to argue that both Martinez and Tapia were involved in the confrontation in the yard. It's not nearly as persuasive to argue that once dragged to the street, Martinez was complicit in Tapia's actions. That final action, in the context of him yelling and cursing at the victim and taking out the gun and shooting him, seems like an impulsive act, more of self-congratulatory bravado for having won the fight than anything else. And that is why I think we have to look at it in a narrow context, because how is Tapia to know, I mean, how is Martinez to know that Tapia had put him on doing that, or impulsively did that, as a final act of that confrontation?
So just to go back to what Justice Hobbs was talking about with 11 and 12, the instructions, can you address the argument that collectively they serve to adequately inform the jury of what the culpable mental state is for first degree murder? Is it more than just, well, 12 came last, therefore it didn't adequately inform?
Well, I think that's an important point, but it's not the only one. So when you contrast this case to what happened in the Key case, in the Key case, there the instructional error was down to harmless error. That erroneous instruction was couched, and it was couched in between the correct statutory definition and then another reiteration of the correct statutory definition in the theory of defense instruction. So in that case, it was not the final word that the judge gave. And it was also kind of a small blip in the middle of two correct versions of the statutory definition of deliberation.
So if 13 had just said after deliberation is defined by statute one more time, then it would have been okay?
No, I don't think so. I think that that's one point that we can draw from this distinction between me and this case. But the other point is that here was an abridging instruction. There's no instruction that explained why the two contradictory definitions of deliberation or how it could be reconciled. If you look at the court's language in the Francis B. Fairman case, then I'm not going to remember the part. It talks about how just because there are two contradictory definitional instructions for mental state in a packet of instructions, one is not necessarily cure the other, unless there's a gap filling instruction that explains how those contradictions can be reconciled. For example, and I think I gave that example in my brief, if there had been a gap-filling instruction such as, am I one thought following another? We need to say the entire thought process, including, you know, kind of adequate for reflection and judgment.
The example from your brief.
Exactly. There wasn't a such thing here. There were simply two contradictory definitions of deliberation. And there's no way to tell which one the jury thought was correct.
Go ahead.
You can stay with that. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to move to a related issue, but just ample evidence versus overwhelming evidence. Assuming it's plain error review, and we're addressing in part whether there is overwhelming evidence is the phrase that I am more accustomed to seeing. Here, the Court of Appeals used the term ample evidence. Can you talk about whether there's a meaningful distinction between the two and how we should apply it here?
I do. I think that there's a huge distinction between ample and overwhelming evidence. Ample evidence, I have no idea how to quantify that, but it certainly doesn't rise to the level of overwhelming. And that's really what we would have to find here. In addition to finding, if you're looking to find the instructional error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, you'd have to find A, that it's clear to the jury to which definition you call out of the two contradictory definitions. And we have to find that the evidence of deliberation on Martinez's part, in addition to Tobias' part, was overwhelming. And we have nothing close to that here. And if you look at the difference between the Key case, where we found overwhelming guilt and deliberation, where the defendant was the principal, not the complicit, the principal, he spoke about killing this man the day before it happened. He drove him up to the mountains, got the victim drunk, shot him four times in the head, and then ran, bashed his head into the rock and ran over his head with a truck. That is what I call overwhelming evidence of deliberation. Do you agree?
Well, the trial judge seemed to be making sort of the same point here. She says the evidence of deliberation was overwhelming in that the victim was shot numerous times and then was dragged out of the yard and into the street and finally dispatched with a shot to the face. Mm-hmm. It's not maybe quite as dramatic, but it's very similar in tone and quantity. What really is the difference?
I think the difference here, Your Honor, is that what happened in the yard is different in nature from what happened on the street. Because what happened in the yard is a separate confrontation. It was a reactionary confrontation, reacting to a perceived threat that the victim himself had lodged against the family, against everyone in the house. The dragging separated the two confrontations. We don't know why he was brought to the street. Actually, there is mention in the record that Sayeta said, get that body out of my yard. So it's not to be assumed that the dragging was necessarily connected to what happened in the street afterward. Since I only have 6 minutes left, I'd like to reserve some time for that.
Certainly, thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado.
Ms. Rohrbaugh, can I ask you, can you lift up that microphone?
This one here?
Yeah, I think that's...
Can you hear me better now?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I have a slight height advantage. I'll start again. May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I have one factual distinction to begin with, which is counsel said that the record contains information that the girlfriend said, get the victim out of my yard, to the two men. My memory is that that statement was only admitted at the preliminary hearing and not at trial, which is an important distinction when we're talking about both of the issues on appeal today, because the issues on appeal, whether the erroneous jury instruction requires reversal, is based on that which was admitted at trial. And similarly, the sufficiency of the evidence also depends on the evidence which was admitted at trial. I'm going to begin with sufficiency, because that's where counsel began. And I think it is most important to notice that the reviewing court must view the evidence in light most favorable to the people to determine if the conviction was supported beyond a reasonable doubt. So counsel has made several suggestions of inferences that would be favorable to the defense from the evidence that was presented. But this court must always look at the evidence presented in the light most favorable to the people in reviewing. You look like you're about to ask a question.
I am. That goes to the sufficiency of the evidence, but does that go to whether there's plain error?
I started with sufficiency. Would you like me to talk
about that? Okay, I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure we weren't conflating the two.
I'd like you to go to plain error if you don't mind.
Okay. I will flip to plain error.
Thank you.
With regard to plain error and the jury instruction here, the standard of review for plain error requires an error that is obvious, substantial, and grave, seriously affecting the substantial rights of the accused. And it occurs when the reviewing court, in looking at the entire record, can conclude with fair assurance that the error so undermined the fundamental fairness of the trial itself, so as to cast serious doubt on the reliability of the judgment of conviction. And it's absolutely important under a plain error standard of review that the burden of establishing plain error is on the defendant. And the defendant establishes plain error by showing a reasonable probability that but for the error claim, the result of the proceeding would have been different. Stated another way, a defendant must satisfy the judgment of the reviewing court, informed by the record, the probability of a different result sufficient to undermine confidence in the proceeding. So when we look at the two instructions here, we have instruction 11 and instruction 12. Instruction 11 properly states our statutory definition of after deliberation. I think we all agree about that. The second definition, which came from case law in, I believe, 1894, said that the interval for deliberation need not be long. And I think, actually, we can probably all agree that that's so. We don't have a time limit on deliberation. We don't say that it has to be more than 15 seconds. We don't say it has to be more than 15 minutes. What matters is that it is not hasty, but it is the fact of reflective thought. So the second part then says it can be merely the time for one thought to follow another. And that's the language that's been disproved in ensuing case law. And so when we look at the facts here, there's no reasonable possibility that it had an effect on the verdict rendered. I think it's very important for a plain error standard of review to note that the prosecution did not argue to the jury that deliberation was simply enough for one thought to follow another. Nor did either side argue that the deliberation was merely the few seconds on the street before the final coup de grace was fired into the victim's head. I think that we have to look at deliberation as the entire process here. And my question would be, having rendered the victim physically helpless, why would you reload the gun unless you intended to kill him? You're not going to further disable him. He's absolutely disabled at the time. I think that having a gun reloaded can only show an intent to kill. And it should be noted a lot, and I realize I've just used the passive voice, it should be noted. And I think that it's true that we have used the passive voice in a discussion of the circumstantial evidence of the drag through the yard and reloading of the gun, simply because we can't say which of the two men were responsible for this action. But if the actions of the two men show that they were acting in concert together. So in talking about whether the jury instruction constitutes plain error, I think we look at this whole time frame of deliberation. We have the physically helpless victim who is dragged down to the street. The gun is reloaded because this is a six-shooter revolver. There were six shots fired, five into the helpless victim, one into the dwelling, I believe. And so the six shooter needed to be reloaded, and it was, in fact, the defendant who had, when the defendant and co-defendant were stopped in the car, bullets for the gun in his pocket. So this shows...
When you say for the gun, how do you know that it was for that particular gun?
Your Honor, I meant that it was the right caliber to fit into the gun. Obviously, other than that, bullets aren't particular to one gun. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
And I have a question, if you don't mind. I read someplace that the defendant was within 2 or 3 feet of the head of the victim when he was shot. Is that correct first?
Yes.
And, what my question really is I don't recall whether that was evidence or that was pretrial.
No, there were the evidence at trial was that I believe there were 7 neighbors who testified with regard to what they observed, because the neighbors, some of them had better vantage points than others, of the two men standing over the body on the street. But those neighbors that provided particular descriptions of the men provided descriptions which tended to show that the co-defendant, who was the shirtless man, was standing at the feet of the victim and fired the final shot into the head of the victim. Whereas the defendant, who was wearing what was described as a racing jersey, was standing at the head of the victim. So we have various comments that were made, and again, some of the reasons that the comments aren't attributed to one man or the other are because the neighbors heard the comments but didn't see who made which of the comments. But one neighbor said that it was the defendant who said, "See what you get when you mess with my house," which would be consistent with the fact that he was living there with the girlfriend and showing his intent and deliberation in the action. The other comment that was made, which shows the two men acting together, is that the comment where one man said to the other, "I got him," tending to show that this was an enterprise that they were engaged in together. I'm afraid by going there, I have strayed perhaps somewhat into the sufficiency argument, but the two claims are very much related in this appeal, because both of them deal in large part with the intent and deliberation of the defendant and the co-defendant.
But the quantum of evidence necessary to show sufficiency and that which is necessary to show plain error are very different things, right? Yeah.
Well, they're very different things. They're different tests. So I think we agree that plain error is the question of whether the error involved rendered the trial fundamentally unfair, whether there was a reasonable possibility the jury was somehow confused based on the evidence and the arguments presented to it. But it's the defendant's burden to overcome plain error, and it's the defendant's burden because trial courts need to have the right information in order to make the right calls. And so that's why the court said in Hagos that reversals for plain error need to be very rare, because the parties have an obligation, along with the trial court, to get it right the first time. So absolutely the standards are different, but in the standard for the fundamental fairness for the instructional issue, it's the defense burden. Now, when we look at the sufficiency of the evidence, As I said, the light is looked at most favorable to the prosecution. So that is a very different question, but it's a question that, as I said, the available evidence is not looked at as to what inference could be drawn from this evidence across the board, but the question is, what's the evidence, what's a reasonable inference that could be drawn in the light most favorable to the prosecution?
What about ample versus overwhelming? Perhaps you can address that issue from your perspective.
Well, I think probably it's easiest to say that ample would certainly suffice for sufficiency. That I think that would meet a sufficiency standard.
Right. Over, no quarrel there. I'm right. Saying on the plain error issue.
Right. On the plain error issue, one of the ways that we show that an error is harmless beyond reasonable doubt is overwhelming evidence. And that is the phrase the trial court used. Again, in the motion for new trial, the defense still said that this instruction was unnecessary and prejudicial. They did not say it was an incorrect statement of law. And in denying the statement, the motion for new trial, the court said the court finds evidence of deliberation was overwhelming in that the victim was shot numerous times and then dragged out into the yard, into the street, and finally dispatched with a shot to the face. So we have overwhelming evidence of deliberation. We can argue about which man we are ascribing this deliberation to, but when we're talking about was the jury possibly confused by this instruction, my response is no, because the deliberation is far more than a mere time for one thought to follow another.
Could I ask you to, we've sort of been playing past this, but could you address the preservation question, whether plain error was the right standard at all?
Yes, Your Honor, and my view is the Court of Appeals was correct that this is a plain error standard of review. The reason is, as I mentioned earlier to Justice Hood, that the parties have an obligation to alert the trial court to problems. And so saying this is unnecessary or superfluous is definitely not the same thing as saying this is an incorrect statement of law. Because I would be willing to bet that if the trial court here was told this is an incorrect statement of law, the trial court would not have given the instruction.
Do you think an objecting party has an obligation to bring to the court's attention case law that's authorization or support for its position?
I think it does. I think perhaps the problem that happened in this case was that the court and the parties were looking at the annotations in the statute book without regard to what constituted the more recent and current state of the law. But I think clearly the parties have an obligation to support their arguments that they make to the trial court.
And so does it follow from that? You're suggesting it would be an inadequate and not a contemporaneous objection, and not an effective contemporaneous objection to fail to cite case law in support of your objection?
I'm not sure. I think case law would be useful, but merely saying this is an incorrect statement of law, I think, might get you out of plain error. But I think it would be useful, if you're saying this is an incorrect statement of law, I think it would be very useful to parties to say this is an incorrect statement of law based on Key.
So the failure to cite Key, or even a wrongful reference to Key, you don't think would be problematic with regard to whether you made a contemporaneous objection? You're saying as long as the objector had made it clear she was objecting on the grounds that it was wrong law?
Yes. And in particular, as I said, the objector then ratified the law, saying those cases say and the law is now.
So, interesting point. Stay with that a minute. So what effect do you think that has? If she had not done that, would it still have been an ineffective objection? Or is that integral to finding that it was not an effective contemporaneous objection?
Your Honor, I think that even without it, it would not be an effective objection, because the objection was this is superfluous, it's not necessary. She does not say that, in fact, this is an incorrect statement of law, which I think is what, in fact, we're talking about here, which would have alerted the trial court to looking further into the situation. So I think that what the statement of counsel ratifying that it was a correct statement of law does is merely reinforces that this is a plain error standard of review.
Okay, thank you.
I'm a little bit concerned about this part too, because trial attorney is the heat of battle, face it. And you don't actually sometimes say what you intend to say. The defense counsel here did object to the giving of instruction 12, did she not?
Yes, she objected. As I said, she said it was unnecessarily enhanced.
It was unnecessary. In other words, instruction 11 has all of it. And then the trial court had, after the verdict, the chance to look at this and said it's preserved for review. It's preserved for review. So as an appellate court, isn't that what we should be concerned about, to look at the issue of law, whether it's preserved or in effect waived because it hasn't been adequately preserved? So as far as I know, we don't have a definitive definition of what you have to do as a trial counsel to preserve an issue, and it plagues all kinds of review. So let's just assume now that it was preserved as the trial judge said, right? After the verdict, looking at it, it's preserved. Let's assume that's the case. I think that's the case here. What is the standard of review then, if it's adequately preserved in the trial court?
Well, Your Honor, I have three responses to your question, so I want to sort of...
Well, it's a six-part question, so that...
I think that the trial court did not say that it was preserved here. This is in the motion for new trial, paragraph 6.
Right.
The court does not say it was preserved. I think that what preserves the issue is a contemporaneous contemporaneous objection, because we need an objection in time for the trial court to correct errors. That's the point of an objection. And I believe that it's Rule 30 that requires contemporaneous objections to jury instructions. So I think that this is not a preserved error because there was not a correct contemporaneous instruction. The final part of your question is, if it were a preserved error, what would the standard of review be? And the standard of review would be whether it was harmless, and the prosecution would have the burden to show it's harmless, as opposed to the defense having the burden. The plain error standard of review shifts the burden.
That's a considerable difference, correct?
It is a considerable difference. And again, plain error requires that the trial has been rendered fundamentally unfair, so that we are not satisfied with the reliability of the judgment.
So let's assume now that we're going to write an opinion having to do with what the standard for preservation is, so that counsel will know for all time in trial what that is. How would you phrase it?
You mean the harmless standard?
The contemporaneous preservation of a legal issue.
Well, Your Honor, I haven't briefed that in this case, but my understanding is that this is also a substantial error that affects affects substantial rights, and it affects the outcome of the case.
The preservation standard includes that? I'm talking about what needs to be done by trial counsel contemporaneously that we could define an opinion that preserves something for appellate review.
Absolutely. To be preserved for appellate review, the objection must be contemporaneous, and it must be that point which is raised on review.
The same issue, instead of allowing it to morph through briefing as often happens, has got to be succinctly stated by trial counsel. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, absolutely. That it doesn't, because that is what alerts the trial court judge to the potential for error, is a correct, explicit instruction. And that then is what fires the standard of review, because, as I said, this court said in Hagos, we look at the standard as being very, very high for plain error. It has to be something the trial court should have taken notice of on its own, and it also needs to give us cause to doubt the reliability of the verdict and the fundamental fairness of the trial. And so absolutely it needs to be on the same basis that's going to be raised on appeal. And here my position is that we have sufficient evidence of intent and deliberation, absolutely.
And counsel, if we were to disagree with you about the preservation and conclude that in fact it was properly preserved, that the constitutional harmless error standard were the standard of review, how does the state still win? I noticed in the brief you walk us through a plain error analysis, but what would we look at to say that the state nonetheless prevails on appeal here, even under constitutional harmless error standard?
I think that the state would still win for the same reasons I've set forth, and which is to say, again, if you look at the Key case, although it was admitted that that was error, and apparently the court found that it had been preserved in the Key case, nonetheless, it did not require reversal. And so if we look in the present case, it's true that the defendant was not the principal, but the complicitor. But I still say that there is overwhelming evidence of deliberation.
And that's exactly what I'd like you to focus on. So what, in your view, is the overwhelming evidence of deliberation in this record? How does it meet the overwhelming standard?
In looking at this case, the way I look at how there was evidence of deliberation, which, as I said, I believe is overwhelming, falls into three categories. First, the victim being dragged, and especially the gun being reloaded. The victim, particularly the gun being reloaded, as I said, why would you reload a gun unless you intended and were planning to shoot the victim and kill him? Because there would be no reason to load the gun in order to disable him. He is already disabled at that point.
And fair enough, but how do you attribute that to Martinez as opposed to Tapia?
Well, there are two ways. The first way is that we do know that Martinez was the one who, when they were caught, had the bullets that would go in the gun. But we also have the information that they acted in concert, right? We have the dueling experts regarding whether it would require one man or two men to drag the body through the yard. And the prosecution's expert said that based on the injuries, which were only to the back and not the limbs or the buttocks of the victim, that would show that he was brought through the yard by two people. But even if only one man dragged the body through the yard, that could be because the other man was reloading the gun. So again, the two of them are acting in concert together. We also have, as evidence of deliberation, these statements that were made at the side of the victim on the street. All of these statements, I mean, after all, this man has been disabled. His femur has been broken by a shot, so he can't stand up. And he also has his right arm is useless. There's no reason, unless you're intending to kill him, to stand there and continue to taunt him and then shoot him in the head, rather than just walk away. I mean, it shows intent and deliberation. And as I said, some of these statements we can attribute to both the two men working together or perhaps to the defendant. Finally, we can draw some inferences from the fact that the defendant's girlfriend is the victim's wife. And so he's the one, as the prosecutor said in closing argument, he's the one who has the dog in his fight. He's the one who has the relationship with the girlfriend. We also have the relationship with the girlfriend. He had her car and her gun and the ammunition for it. All of this shows on his part some kind of intent and deliberation, and we can attribute that to defendant. whereas some of the...
Did the other guy just happen to be there on the porch? Is that... I never quite understood his role.
Mr. Tapia?
Yeah, did he just happen to be there?
I think he'd been staying there also.
Okay.
The men, as I believe they were friends, although when the car was stopped and the defendant was asked about the shooting, the defendant said, "What shooting? My girlfriend just told me to give this guy a ride." So he disavowed a relationship with the co-defendant and also disavowed a knowledge of the shooting. But I believe other evidence in the record shows that they were friends and Tapia was also staying
there. Now, these six neighbors who testified, five or six neighbors who testified, was their testimony pretty consistent as to both of the men being involved?
Well, we don't have testimony until they get to the street.
Right.
So the testimony was with regard to what had happened in the street. Some of them, it goes to show that eyewitness testimony, people remember different things because there are a number of different statements that are made. But the witnesses were fairly consistent in saying that it was the man with the tattoos by the feet of the victim who fired the final shot into the victim's head, whereas the defendant was identified as the man who was wearing racing jersey. And I believe the man I identified in my brief as the first neighbor, after the car was stopped, identified these as the men he had seen. So I think in terms of consistency of the neighbors' testimony, they were able to see different things from different perspectives, but the descriptions of the men were consistent and their relative placement by the victim.
Do you think that in order to be guilty as a complicitor, the complicitor of first-degree murder, of deliberation murder, the complicitor has to deliberate?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor. I mean, what we say is that the defendant has to have the same mindset, the same mens rea, as the principal. So I think for first-degree murder...
Actually, we say he has to intend to facilitate the crime, don't we?
Well, let me look at the statutory language. A person is legally accountable as principal for the behavior of another constituting a criminal offense with the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the offense. He or she aids, abets, advises, or encourages the other person in planning or committing the offense. So I guess that's the aiding and abetting language. I'm going to have to flip to the jury instruction.
So I take it from that language you just read, which was the language I see too, that the complicitor has to intend to facilitate a crime of deliberation.
Yes.
Do you mind if I...
No, please.
No. So, as I understand it, the three most compelling pieces of evidence from the prosecution standpoint would be the circumstantial evidence that the gun was reloaded, the bullets in the pocket of Martinez, and the language about that's what you get, right? Those
definitely seem to show intent and after deliberation. With regard to the issue of complicity, I think that we look also to the dragging of the body and also the getaway.
We don't really know who dragged the body, right? The evidence is not as compelling in that respect. Would you agree?
Your Honor, I think the evidence is compelling that he was dragged by one man or the other. I don't think there's any evidence that there was a third party that dragged the body. I think that we can, and again, we're drawing inferences most favorable to the people, but I think it's fair to say that after there's the drag mark, and of course this is circumstantial evidence, so we're drawing an inference from it, but if you look at the drag mark through the yard and the fact that the neighbors then see the two men standing over the body, I think it's clear that he was dragged by perhaps both men together or one of the two men to get to the curb.
Counsel, can I just go back to the preservation issue? You suggest that the objection here was it was unnecessary, superfluous. But doesn't counsel go one step beyond that and say this additional instruction unnecessarily emphasizes this formulation or this time the timing, one thought after another, versus the lead-up. I mean, doesn't counsel say that that unnecessarily emphasizes that time?
Just aside, my position would still be that this is an unnecessary claim and not a claim of legal inaccuracy. So I don't think that it removes the case from a plain error standard of review.
Okay, so saying that it does something wrong, that goes one step further, don't you think, from it's superfluous, but you say it doesn't matter? Because
this is legally incorrect. Because as I said, legally incorrect, I think there's no way the trial court would have given an instruction that the trial court was told was legally incorrect. I think the trial court has discretion to give an additional instruction defining crimes.
Thank you.
I see I'm out of time. I thank this court and this high school for your time and attention. I'd ask you to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Jeffrey, we have a little final one remaining, I believe. 6.5 minutes.
I'd like to start by responding to Justice Coates' question about whether, under the complicity theory, the state can prove that Martinez deliberated. I think you'll find under Bogdanoff case clarified the dual mental state requirement for complicity. And the first requirement of that is that the alleged complicitor share the whole mental state of the principal, not just that they aided and abetted. But they did so with that shared culpable mental state. And here, that culpable mental state required intent after the deliberation. That's what separates complicity from an accomplice after the fact.
So I understand your argument, and I know we're getting a lot of feedback, but let me see if you can get this.
Okay.
So is it your position that even though the two men were standing at head and foot of the man, that the shooter just did so
impulsive.
So in such an impulsive way that there could not have been deliberation on the part of Mr. Martinez to facilitate or to help with this shooting?
I don't know if there could not have been.
The evidence is so clear that they were both there, both neighbors or all of the neighbors are saying they looked like they were in it together.
I don't think the neighbors did say that.
Okay, could you help me with that?
Sure. The neighbors described what they saw through the windows, you know, in the adjacent homes. And what they saw was a man lying on the street, the victim. They saw Tapia at the feet of the man. They saw Martinez at the head of the man. And then they heard shouting and cursing. And the overwhelming consensus of who did the shouting and cursing was Tapia. Tapia shouted and cursed and then took out the gun and shot him in the head. There was, like Zorba noted, one witness who said that Martinez may have been the one to shout, "See what you get for messing with my house." But even if that statement came out of Martinez's mouth, that is a retrospective statement. That statement talks about what has already happened. That statement talks about the victim being shot in the yard after he tried to come and kill the family in the house. That statement is not, I don't think it's reasonably read as prospectively was about to happen. That's a retrospective statement, and so there's no way to tell from that single statement that he had any idea that the victim was about to be shot in the head by Tapia. I'd like to also comment on the standard of review for the erroneous instruction. It is the trial court's duty to properly instruct the jury on the law. And here we've been splitting hairs over whether the defense counsel's multiple objections put the trial court on notice of possible error in the erroneous instruction. But where's the trial court's duty to get it right? Here, defense counsel objected multiple times because they were talking about not only that language coming in under the deliberation instruction, but also the premeditation instruction. I think defense counsel objected 3 or 4 times within the course of that colloquy. and it would have only taken the trial court about 5 minutes to hop on Westlaw, plug in the language to check for its validity, and find that under Key and Sneed, it was legally erroneous.
Can I ask one question there, yes, along the lines that we've asked both of you leading up to this on preservation? With regard to this point about not specifically specificity, but rather, in this case, do you actually have defense counsel conceding the validity, the legal validity of this proposition? And in that case, is there an aspect of invitation about this?
No and no.
Okay.
And here's why. I think it was a confusing statement, but I think she was conceding that that law was logically made sense in the context of the review for sufficiency of evidence by an appellate court. But she never conceded that it was correct or proper language in the context of a jury instruction. That was the point she was trying to make. She referred to the annotations of the statute. And what she was trying to say was that in the Brandy and Henning cases, were those cases that they were looking at, the annotations to the statute, that those cases involved a different analysis. Analysis by an appellate court saying, was there sufficient time for deliberation in this case in the light most favorable to prosecution, right? But when you're instructing the jury, you're not instructing the jury in the light most favorable to the prosecution. You're instructing the jury on the law. I'd also like to comment briefly about a couple points of evidence that opposing counsel described in order to try and convince this court that there was ample or overwhelming evidence of his complicity in a culpable mental state for the first degree murder. Let's talk about the gun for a second. In Tapia's trial, the prosecution argued that Tapia did all of the shooting in the case. And while he was not willing to make that same argument for obvious reasons in Martinez's trial, he did concede out of the hearing of the jury that he still believed that the gun did not pass back and forth. Just because Martinez had bullets in his pocket that he had hit the gun really means nothing, because we know who the shooter was in this case. It's undisputed. It was Tapia. I guess I only have 10 seconds. I'll try very quickly to say one more thing about the preservation issue. And that is, I think that stating case law is helpful when you're trying to preserve an issue, but it's never necessary. I think just saying objection should be enough to put the trial court on notice of a possible error. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your argument, Ms. Jeffrey, and yours as well, Ms. Gorbaugh. The court will be in recess for a little while you take some questions from the students, and then we will come back and answer your questions as well. Thank you.